Dr. Maple Go, and welcome to Dr. Not Otherwise Specified, also known as Dr. NOS. This podcast is to provide guidance for our junior doctors to navigate medical and non-medical careers. I hope all the doctors out there can get something out of this, whether they're specified or not. Kia pai tora. To another episode of Dr. NOS. Today we have Dr. Lupe Tomoe-Bea. She is a vascular and transplant surgeon at Wellington Hospital and is a clinical senior lecturer at the University of Otago. She is the first New Zealand female vascular surgeon and only Pacific Island vascular surgeon in Australasia. She received her fellowship from the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons in 2014 after completing training throughout New Zealand and Queensland, Australia. Lupe is actively involved in mentoring Pacific Island students and female junior doctors considering a career in surgery and has a strong interest in pre-vocational medical education. Outside of medicine, Lupe enjoys cheering for her son on the side of the soccer field and basketball court, exploring the outdoors with her family and dog, and is looking forward to getting back to Tonga once the borders have reopened. Thank you very much for joining me today, Lupe. How are you?
Great. Thank you, Kia ora and malolele. It's a real pleasure to be part of your amazing podcast. So thank you for having me.
An absolute honour and privilege.
Excellent pronunciation of my name, by the way. Well done.
After some coaching before the podcast, I can't claim the credit of that.
But the thing is, you asked me how to pronounce it, which is a big thing when it's your name and it's your identity, right? So it means a lot to me when people actually take the time to ask me how to pronounce it and are interested in pronouncing it correctly, because it's who I am. It's me.
It feels like such a low bar for, you know, just like basic respect and dignity as well, to be able to pronounce things right. I feel like that's a real basic thing we could do better in New Zealand, because we have such a dense population of Pacific Islanders that we should just learn how to pronounce their names properly.
Absolutely. There are, after every All Blacks game or whenever the Kiwis are playing, it's interesting seeing people firing off things on Twitter about the terrible pronunciation of Pacific Island names, when, especially because we're increasing in number, we make up almost 10% of our population and we've been immigrating to this country for a long time, but there's just a real lag in terms of, yeah, as you say, the kind of basic respect of, in terms of actually taking the time to teach yourself how to pronounce these names that are not actually that hard, to be honest. It's a very, most Pacific Island languages are reasonably phonetic. Tongan is very close to Māori in terms of its pronunciation, but it's a work in progress. But yeah, anyway, thank you.
I'm sure we could go on for forever about the kind of care that Pacific Island patients receive and how it's so different and the inequities in that kind of delivery of care. But before we dive into the heavy hitters of the subjects, I'd love to hear about how you found medicine and how you got into medicine in the first place.
Sure. So my family is from Tonga, and my parents were both born in Tonga and came from very typical large Pacific Island families. So both of my parents come from, my mum's one of 11 and my dad's one of 13 children. And my grandfather on my dad's side was an ophthalmologist in Tonga. And being an ophthalmologist in Tonga actually meant you're a real true generalist as well. He was the GP, he was also the obstetrician, but for a long time he was the only ophthalmologist in Tonga. So I guess there's a bit of medicine, that there's a bit of background in terms of my family being medical, but my parents weren't medically trained. They both moved to New Zealand. My dad went to spend some time going to boarding school in Auckland and then came back later for further study. And my mum came out in the early 60s, and both of them basically to find a better life. They didn't meet till they came to New Zealand, and then they had my sister and I. And I guess from a young age, there's a real sense of community and looking after each other, which is common to a lot of cultures, but in the Pacific Island culture and the Tongan culture, it's a real big factor in terms of your upbringing and your cultural identity. That sense of community, looking after each other, was just something that my mum in particular ingrained in my sister and I. So I think, I guess, that sort of caring for other people was just part of who I was. And it was funny, like when I was growing up, I used to love playing doctors and nurses and had dolls and a teddy bear that I used to like patch up and pretend I was giving medicine to and things like that. I don't know. I think from a young age, I was almost destined for it because it was something that I started telling people that I was going to become a doctor from the age of 5. And I really loved school. I was a real geek. I was like the teacher's pet at school. And I really loved learning, like, you know, going to the library in the weekends was a real highlight. My mum would take my sister and I. And so I just, you know, just loved reading, loved absorbing information. And I guess I saw medicine as a real marrying of those two things, the whole learning, an ongoing learning, as well as a way of, you know, providing a service. And I think because I was very close to my grandfather, he was a real role model in my life. And I remember being really interested in his stories about restoring people's sight. I used to, when we would visit him in Tonga, I loved looking at using his stethoscope and looking. He had like an old microscope that he had at home that I used to look through. And yeah, so I was just always really interested in it. And I never changed my mind about medicine. I went to high school expecting almost to go to medical school. And because I went to an all-girl Catholic school in Auckland, women were really celebrated. And it was, in my world at the time, women could do absolutely anything. The Tongan culture is very matriarchal. So women have a very high standing in the family. And I have lots of, you know, really strong female role models in my family itself. My mum, she was a solo mum for a long time. And so all the women around me were just forging ahead, doing whatever it is they wanted to do. And then I went to a school that kind of just nurtured that for me. So I never changed my mind and never thought that getting into medical school was beyond me. I did have to work pretty hard. Like, although I loved school, I wasn't like I still had to put in a lot of work. And when I came to apply for medical school, I was a true Jaffa in that I never once considered going to Dunedin, partly because I'm terrible when it's cold. It drops below 11 degrees and my brain doesn't function. But also, I just wanted to be close to my family. So I applied for medical school in Auckland and I went through the Māori Pacific Island Admission Scheme, that was my first exposure to a mentoring program, right? Because up until that point, I hadn't needed that sort of support because as I said, in my worldview, I was going to go to medical. I wanted to be a doctor. I was going to get into, and that's what I was going to do. End of story. I didn't have a plan B, really. But then I got to medical school and things changed because I wasn't around me. There were people suddenly telling me that I wasn't supposed to be there, that I, you know, had got in on lower marks, and that was part of this group that had this free ride into medical school. Just the ongoing rhetoric that is still going on in 2022. And yeah, when I found med school a little bit challenging because I was being challenged. Like the story that I told myself for the last 17 years, or sorry, 12 years from the age of 5, was that I was going to be a doctor. And then suddenly I was in this environment that wasn't particularly supportive, as in the institution wasn't supportive, but thankfully I had my MAPS brothers and sisters around me. And we had a good size of MAPS students in my year, and we were really close, and we were close with all of the other Pacific Island and Māori students through all the various years at med school. To this day, I credit that group of individuals with helping getting me through because, yeah, they're amazing. It was like I have one sister, and although my extended family is massive, my immediate family is small, but suddenly I had all these brothers and sisters who were instantly brothers and sisters. And so that was a bit of a learning curve for me in terms of having to tell myself my story over and over again that, yes, I have worked hard to get here. I deserve to be here. But yeah, it was a pretty confronting time. I'd turn up to a lecture and or a small group tutorial, and my tutor would say, oh, are you in the right place? Surprised that I was there, surprised that I'd done the pre-reading. And yeah, part of me, second year was a real struggle for me because the first year I was like, what? I'm not supposed to be here. No, that's not right. And so then, yeah, second year, I really found it hard to find the motivation and at times. And I decided probably in first year that I wanted to be a surgeon again because I wanted to be like my grandfather and to be able to fix people with my hands. But I failed anatomy in second year. And then I was like, what? This doesn't make sense. How did I fail anatomy, you know? But it was a lesson in prior to studying university, I'd done lots of things. All of my work I'd just done by myself. And I didn't have this group around me to support me. But in second year after failing anatomy, it was a bit of a wake-up call in terms of actually asking for help and being a bit more active in terms of seeking that support with study and things like that. I'm getting lost in my story, Maple. So basically decided pretty early on that I was going to be a surgeon. And then when I was in fourth year, I was attached to my first run in surgery was in orthopedics. And that was up at Auckland Hospital. And I was on a team where Terry Bidwell, who's a pediatric orthopedic surgeon at Starship now, she was the fellow on the team at the time. And I remember meeting Terry and just being in awe of her. And she took me to theatre. I scrubbed in with her. That was my first time ever in theatre. And for most of the operation, all I got to do was hold a sucket. But I was just like, this is amazing. And then she was plating a tibial fracture. And anyway, she let me screw one of the screws. And then she printed out the op note and she put my name on as the assistant. And it was back in the day when you used to print x-rays. And so she printed an x-ray and then gave it to me as a memento of being on the team. And I was just blown away by that experience. Like, she probably has zero memory of this experience with me, zero idea of who I am. But that was, for me, massive in terms of shaping me, because all of a sudden I saw this amazing woman and I was just like, wow, I want to be Terry. You know, she was kind. She was also really well respected. Like in the handover meetings, people would ask her for her opinion, and she was just what I wanted to be. For most of my clinical term, I wanted to be a orthopedic surgeon. And then I did the run as a house surgeon. And then I decided, actually, I liked ortho because I liked Terry. And actually, the surgery wasn't as cool as I had thought it was. And then I spent a couple of runs doing plastics and loved the surgery. I loved the sort of reconstructive element. I was on a team that did a lot of craniofacial surgery for children. And I just saw how life-changing that was for them. And then I decided, okay, no, I'm going to switch tack. No, also I'm going to go down to the plastics. And then I ended up doing a term in vascular surgery as a second year house surgeon. And I didn't even really know what vascular surgery was. I've had very little exposure to it as a medical student. I think I did a run in Waikato as a fourth year, or maybe I was a TI, and someone was talking about a ruptured aneurysm that was going on in the theatre next door. And myself and one of my friends, we popped our heads in and we were like, oh, wow, that's cool. There's just a lot of blood. I just remember there being lots of blood and thinking, messy. Not sure about that. When I cycled back to it as a house surgeon, I found my people. I worked on in the department at the time, there were four surgeons and they were all male, but they were the first group who all together were really interested in teaching me. I'd worked in lots of different surgical teams where there were one or two really great role models in terms of teachers and mentors, but this was like the whole department was amazing. And that was from the consultants to the fellow at the time, the registrars, again, another woman who shaped my experience. So Rochelle Salter. She was Salter then. Sorry,
love,
Rochelle.
Love now. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So Rochelle was my registrar. And again, like just this amazing woman who was really kind. Like I remember there was a situation where a patient of ours, a vascular patient who deteriorated quite rapidly on the ward, had to put a med call out and I was first there. And anyway, successful resuscitation. And then I had gone and, you know, that when the medical team had arrived, I'd spent some time just summarizing this guy's multiple issues. And I'd just written a page of a summary, more for myself, but because I was, you know, new on the team and things like that. But she, I remember her coming and asking, you know, the other house surgeon I was working with wanted to have a bit of a debrief about the situation. And I remember her like looking through the notes and then she'd seen this summary that I'd written and she was just like, wow, that's amazing. And I shouldn't have to do that. But she was really kind and like I learned a lot from her about just communicating, taking time on the ward rounds with patients, that kind of stuff. And I knew at the time that she didn't want to do vascular, but she was still really enthusiastic about it. Yeah, I had this amazing team who were, yeah, just really keen on teaching me. And the more surgery I saw, the more I realized that vascular had this kind of reconstructive element to it as well. Yeah, and I actually loved the crusty patients that had vascular. I don't know, like I love the technical side of surgery, but I actually also like the fact that in vascular surgery, I have to think about lots of medical problems. You have to be comfortable managing diabetes and you have to, yeah, I just like that complex kind of medical patient. And also the fact that they bounce in and out of hospital means you develop this long-term relationship with a lot of vascular patients. So, yeah, all of those elements led me down this path of choosing vascular as my career. And yeah, people ask me, would I do it again? And 100% do it again every day. Give me a manky foot any day, any day, Nathan.
I'd die for a manky foot.
I'd take that over so many other things in medicine, I tell you. I see patients in clinic and I go to examine them. They're like, oh, sorry about my feet. And I'm like, I don't know. It's like my special skill that I can't smell it. Manky feet, that's what I love. That's my bread and butter.
I think perhaps we need to explain this a little bit more for the junior listeners who might not, you know. So just be like, does Lupe have a foot fetish?
Oh my goodness. When I listen back to this, I'll be saying to myself, okay, filter. Yes. Okay.
Context. Yeah.
Context. All right.
So what is vascular surgery? What is the bulk of your work? Why do you see so many manky feet?
Okay. So vascular surgery is basically I operate on blood vessels and a lot of the work that I do is on treating peripheral vascular disease. So peripheral vascular disease that affects the lower limbs, often patients will present with what we call chronic limb-threatening ischemia, so ulcers on the feet, wrist pain, that kind of thing. And the slang for a foot with an ulcer or infection is a manky foot. And yeah, that's a manky feet make up a big part of my practice, as well as other disease and other arterial beds. So I deal with carotid surgery in patients who've had stroke or to prevent stroke. I deal with aneurysms, sort of dilatations in arteries. I do, and the manky foot, I guess the definitive treatment of the manky foot is twofold. There are minimally invasive procedures where we cross lesions with wires and stretch them with balloons and do angioplasty or stent, or the more traditional surgery of bypass surgery in the lower limb with often a venous conduit. Yeah. And then I also do kidney transplant in Wellington, which is probably one of the most satisfying and rewarding operations I do.
What is how does transplant fall into vascular? Like, is that like a separate training or is it related to vascular because it's kidneys? You'll have to enlighten me on this. I'm really naive in this field.
Yeah. Transplant surgery is its own, I guess, has its own training program and fellowship. And you can do it through multiple different routes. So you can do it as a vascular surgeon, you can do it as a general surgeon or trauma surgeon. Those are probably the two most common routes, and it's like an extra fellowship that you do. Although some surgeons, like myself, for example, I haven't done a formal transplant fellowship. I've been grandfathered into it through the other vascular and transplant surgeons in Wellington. Yeah, it just really, I guess, feel really blessed that I can use that my skill set to perform such a life-changing operation for patients with renal failure.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hear you when you talk about vascular, you talk about, I guess, the chronicity of it, being able to see patients develop over that time and to be able to reap the benefits of that surgery. And of course, all the manky feet that you get to see is a huge plus as well. But what drew you to transplant surgery? What is it that you love about it?
I say to people, like, I don't think there's any operation. You know, a lot of surgeons, sorry, I'm going to start again. A lot of surgeons, you know, love surgery for that instant result or that instant satisfaction or gratification you get from doing something with your hands, right? The classic example in vascular surgery is somebody comes in with an ischemic leg and their foot is white, it's freezing cold, they can't move it, and it's numb, or they've got pins and needles. Then you take them to theater and you fish out the clot, or you do an embolectomy or thrombectomy. And then you unclamp the vessel, and then suddenly their foot's pink and they can move it. Transplant is like it's next level instant satisfaction. I don't think there's anything that I do that is more satisfying than the moment when you unclamp the artery and the vein. So the donor's external iliac vessels, and then you see this shriveled up grey kidney turn initially purple, and then it turns pink, and then you actually see it visibly pulsate, the kidney itself, right? And then sometimes a few minutes later, you'll actually see urine coming out of the ureter, and I call it liquid gold at that point, because that's what it is for the patient. Like, dialysis is, I don't think the general public understand how much impact it has on somebody's lifestyle and their quality of life. So dialysis for a lot of patients involves at least 2 or 3 sessions a week. They can be hooked up to a dialysis machine anywhere between 4 and 6 hours often. And for a lot of patients, it involves travel long distances. So in our region, we have a dialysis unit in Porirua. We have a dialysis unit in Wellington. We've recently had a dialysis unit open at the Hutt. But for anyone who's not living in those centres, for example, if you're up in the Kapiti Coast or if you're in the Wairarapa, that's hours of travel 3 times a week. And so it makes it really hard to have a job sometimes, to look after your family, all of those things. And so if you can go from that to, you know, being lucky enough to have a kidney transplant and not need dialysis, it's just massive. I remember, you know, one patient who had a transplant from a deceased donor, and I went in to meet him before his operation, and he just couldn't stop crying because he was so happy. He's just like, when I got that call, I initially thought somebody was pranking me, and then I realized, oh no, this is not a joke. And he just said, I feel like I've won lotto. And, you know, that's what it's like. So it's just hugely humbling and amazing to be part of that and to be able to help give that to a patient.
Mm. And it sounds like with transplant surgery, they're truly life-changing and life-altering courses, and the same in not just like renal transplants, but any kind of transplant that most of them do, it's truly life-altering. But vascular has some of those same threads as well, similar threads with repairing dissecting aortas or ruptures. Do you get the same feeling from it, or is it different for you?
I get the same feeling from all of those operations that I do, but it's just different amounts of awesomeness, if that makes sense. That's really terrible English, isn't it? Sometimes that is truly like indescribable how happy I feel after a really good outcome for a patient, particularly the type of operation where there's multiple teams involved. I do, you know, some work with the cardiothoracic team here in Wellington where we spend weeks planning complex procedures that are really high risk but are absolutely needed. For example, you know, patients who have genetic aortic problems like Marfan's who develop widespread aneurysms affecting the thoracic and abdominal aorta. And some of those operations can take up to 14, 16 hours. Of course, with that all goes well and you've put so much time and effort and energy into planning that, then I absolutely get the same kind of feeling. It's a bit strange though that with ruptured aortic aneurysms, yes, I am always pleased when it goes well, but because that type of pathology has such a bad prognosis, sometimes the bar is set so low for those patients. So 50% of patients who rupture in the community will make it to hospital, and of that group, only 50% will make it through surgery. So the odds are really stacked against them. And it's weird. I guess I should be feeling potentially more, get the same kind of high, right, when those procedures go well. But to be honest, I'm always just, oh, that was really close. That, you know, it's a miracle if they get off the table alive sometimes, and then even more of a miracle when they get out. But I get the same rush from any surgery I do. But yeah, there's just something about transplant that is, you know, as I say, it's next level.
I suppose the setup really makes a difference as to how you feel about it. Like if they come in having a bad prognosis, it's really different to being really hopeful and optimistic for a transplant surgery.
Yeah, 100%. Absolutely. Mm. I think that definitely has an impact.
I'm really curious to hear, because I know that especially as being like the first female vascular surgeon, the only Pacific Islands vascular surgeon, like all of these descriptors are really impressive, but at the same time, it can be really lonely. And I've heard about that from many other pioneering Pacific Islander specialists, like Nani Tangaloa, who also knows you.
Amazing.
What amazing woman. And she was like, it's actually really lonely being at the top. She's like, I don't want to be the first and the only. I want to be one of many. How do you feel about it? How has the landscape changed for you? And how have you navigated this space?
So when I went into vascular surgery, I didn't actually have an appreciation for the fact that there weren't any other New Zealand women trainees at the time. And I think part of it was because there were I didn't choose it because I wanted to be this trailblazer or anything like that. I just found what I loved, found the people that I really looked up to and who inspired me. And then I went for it. And it actually wasn't until I had my fellowship that somebody said, do you realize that you're it? And that was one of my, you know, mentors, Andrew Hill, who's a vascular surgeon in Auckland, who said that to me. And then I was like, okay. And to be honest, I don't know why there aren't more women in vascular surgery. Like, I think there is this perception that vascular surgeons have a really terrible lifestyle because people think that we are in the hospital out of hours a lot with trauma and ruptures and dissections and the rest of it. But I think because it's a small specialty, we're the second smallest. So I think pediatric surgery is the smallest specialty in Australasia, and vascular is next. Because there are only a small number of us in Aotearoa, you're in the units that you're in, obviously small number of surgeons, you're on call often, more often than some of your general or orthopedic colleagues who have bigger departments. But I don't actually get called in that much. But yeah, the fact that I was the first New Zealand female sort of trained in Australasia, I guess I didn't have time to think about the fact that I was the only one. Well, not that I had time, but it wasn't a big feature. It wasn't something that sort of stuck out to me on my radar. And I think that probably speaks to the fact that the culture within vascular surgery anyway, that I had experience was generally really positive. The reason I was attracted to vascular, as I said, was because of the people initially, and the consultants and the registrars and the fellows that I worked with in Waikato initially, where I was exposed to vascular, sort of never really, like the fact that I was a woman, the fact that I was Pacific Islander, minority, those things just never came up in conversation. Like it was back to my worldview before I went to university. It was like, of course you can do this. Like you've got the good, go for it. And we will help you get to where you want to be. And even now that, even once I sort of got there, I had a few other female trainees in my year group. So again, it sort of didn't ever really feel that lonely because I was, you know, really close with these other amazing women. And then we became vascular surgeons all together. You know, they're Australian, but yeah, I am aware of being in this real minority group, but I don't know. I'm just really excited about trying to bring other people along with me, to be honest, rather than necessarily feeling lonely, because I feel like I have good support from lots of other people, the colleagues in my department, vascular surgeons generally in New Zealand. I like to say to people that we're all pretty normal, like, which is why I was attracted to the specialty. I mean, you get egos in any specialty, but I don't know, something about vascular, everybody just got on in the departments that I've worked in, and were, you know, just really professional in their dealings with each other, really collegial. Yeah, so I'm not sure that I would say that it's lonely being in the position that I am, because I think I've got good support around me, but yeah, I'm always looking for ways to attract other women. And since I've finished, we now have two other New Zealand women who've finished, which is amazing. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to attract them to come back to work in Aotearoa. That's a work in progress. I do have other female vascular surgical colleagues in New Zealand who are amazing. So there's Jo Chrysler, who's in Dunedin, and Carmen Ruiz, who's in Nelson. And both of them are trained in the UK, very much, very much Kiwis now. Yeah, that we're getting there slowly, very slowly.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've mentioned mentorship and how you're passing that on by mentoring Pacific Island students. And it sounds like mentorship and role modeling has played quite a large role in your life, all the way from the legacy that your grandfather had with being an ophthalmologist and being a generalist in Tonga, all the way through to your map as like brotherhood and sisterhood, and coming through to vascular and how you were even attracted to vascular because of the mentorship and the role modeling you received there. I'd love to hear how this mentoring plays a role in your life now that you're on the other side of that, now that you're mentoring other people.
Yeah, I guess there's a couple of other sort of hats that I wear, which have allowed me to come into this sort of mentoring role. I am a pre-vocational educational supervisor for the medical council. And although that part of that job is helping first and second year house surgeons navigate what's required to get your registration, a big part of that role is pastoral care. And we didn't have anything like that when I was coming through. So I think it's great to be able to just be a point of contact who's constant throughout the year for a young doctor coming through, and just being someone who can help troubleshoot or navigate difficulties either with the system or with things that are happening in people's personal lives that can sometimes affect their ability to do their day job. And I find that role really rewarding, and meeting an intern in their first couple of weeks and seeing this person who's a little bit anxious sometimes or a bit apprehensive about what the year's going to hold, and then just watching them grow through the year professionally as well as personally, I think being able to help make that transition from being a student to being a doctor is a real privilege. And you know, I really enjoy that. That kind of stuff really fills my bucket. Yeah, so I'm involved from helping interns. I am also a mentor for the Wahine Connect mentoring team, and have been able to, just help a couple of house surgeons and registrars talk about what surgery involves, how, you know, what it's like being a woman in surgery, that kind of thing. And I do a lot of that stuff informally as well at the hospital, just with someone, a colleague of mine might send me an email or a text and say, I've got this house surgeon who I think's amazing. She's going to be great at whatever she does, but she is keen to, you know, hear about life as a surgeon, and also involved in mentoring, Pacific Island students in this region through various sort of STEM projects that are run locally. So yeah, I go and talk to high school groups about what surgery, what it means to get in, how to get into med school, what's your med school, what the various sort of training options are and specialties and things like that. And then in the last kind of 18 months, I've been involved in the Pacifica Medical Association. There are so few in our Pacifica workforce, health workforce, right? I think Nani talked about this on her podcast. We make up 8-9% of the population, less than 2% of the health workforce. And so that's been a real mission of mine in terms of coming on board as a director on the Office of PMA, is really trying to strengthen that pipeline. I've just tried to set up a few activities and things to foster that networking early on, so that Pacifica medical students can see Pacific clinicians at every level, as house surgeons, registrars, SMOs, and also just trying to get groups together so that who's in your hospital, for example. There's so few of us. And in our region, sadly, there are only three Pacific SMOs, and one's at Hart Hospital and two are here in Wellington. So I'm on this mission to try and attract Pacifica RMOs to this region and hopefully build that capacity in terms of our workforce. Yeah, I guess that part of my life does take up a reasonable amount of time and energy, but as I said, it's something that I find really rewarding and I think is important and vital in terms of trying to deliver a more equitable and sustainable Pacifica workforce.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's so much work, and sometimes the burden of it falls on the current Pacifica population and the current Pacifica medical workforce, which is a lot of responsibility to bear for a small group of people. And it's part of what we talk about with cultural burdens. You already have to deal with the racism and the currents of dynamics at work and your usual work responsibilities. And on top of that, you have all this extra stuff that you have to deal with because you come from that different ethnicity or because you're Indigenous and suddenly you're representing on the board as that person. I'm super curious to know, it looks like you've carried on that legacy of mentorship and role modeling. Have you ever managed to have that conversation with your grandfather and the role that he played in your life? Did you ever cross paths as doctors at the same time?
Sadly, no. So my grandfather passed away just towards the end of my fourth year. So I had started clinical medicine at least, which was great. And so he knew that I had been talking to patients and examining patients and that sort of stuff. But he didn't see me graduate and hasn't been around for me to share with him exactly how much he meant to me. But I'm sure he's watching from somewhere, and I'd like to think that he would be proud of where I've come, how where I am and what I'm doing. I didn't get to share that story with him, but he certainly meant a lot to me.
Yeah, and it sounds like he lives on in you. And I wonder if you have aspects of the way you practice medicine that carries your grandfather with you, perhaps aspects that you know of how he practiced, or even if it's a cultural thing. Like I know that as somebody from a migrant in Chinese culture, I have bits of that kind of my identity woven into how I practice medicine. And it is really difficult to disentangle. I don't know how much of that is my personality and how much of that is my cultural identity. I don't think they are in two discrete groups. But do you have elements that are part of your heritage and or part of your grandfather that you carry with you?
I think I definitely have elements of my practice that are probably part of my cultural and identity. And I presume part of what who my grandfather was. And things like in a lot of Pacific Island cultures, the idea of storytelling and listening is huge. I find that I treat every kind of patient interaction with the same kind of spirit, in that this person is coming to me with their story. And a lot of clinicians, colleagues, they hate clinic, you know, or surgeons hate clinic. They just want to be in their happy place, you know, with their music, often bad music blaring, doing their craft. The technical side is why a lot of people are drawn to surgery. But I actually love clinic, and to the point where when I started as an SMO, my clinic template had 10 minutes for a first specialist assessment, 10 minutes for a complex vascular patient. I was like, you're joking me. It's not safe for starters, but also I love spending time with patients and getting to know them and that whole, you know, their story. And I tell patients about who I am and that whole kind of sharing of stories, taking time to connect with someone, which I think is a big part of my culture and my upbringing. I 100% do that at work. And it's not just the patients, it's my registrars, it's my house surgeons. I try and get to know, draw out elements of who they are as a person, rather than just what they want to get out of the vascular term or with a patient, you know, what their clinical problem is. Patients always comment to me about how I have this really good memory because I talk to them a lot and I find out about their families and their grandkids. Sometimes I just have patients just come and unload, and we spend the first 10 minutes of a clinical appointment just talking about what's going on in their life, you know, and then we get to the clinical problem and how I'm going to help them and that sort of thing. And that I have patients who come back and see me months later, and then I'm asking them about something that I remember they told me 6 months beforehand. How do you remember this? You must see so many patients. How do you remember that my grandson got a new bike or whatever? And it's just, to me, that's such an important part of, you know, the relationship. Like, sure, I can fix your claudication, you know, can help you with your walking. But I think there's so much more to that therapeutic relationship than just the clinical problem. Yeah, so I feel my granddad was like that. I remember, you know, going to someone's house with him and he'd sit down and I'd be like, oh, here we go. You know, because he'd be like, this is going to be a quick visit. You know, and my mum's exactly the same. My dad's the same. All of my Tongan relatives are the same, which, oh, we're just going to pop in and, you know, say a quick hello to auntie 4 hours later. And I'm a little bit like that with my patients. So like, my clinic template now looks so different. I spend minimum like 20, 25 minutes with each patient. I'm pretty guilty of often spending 45 minutes with a new patient and getting to know them. I'm much better with my follow-ups. And like a 10-minute follow-up slot of my old template is now like a 20-minute follow-up slot. Yeah, just because I really enjoy that aspect. But I think it's a really important part of the care that I try and deliver to patients, yeah.
It's amazing because there must be so many similar threads between Tongan culture and Māori culture, because in Māori culture they call that whakawhanaungatanga. Is there a word for that in Tongan?
I guess it would be osaranga in Tongan. Yeah, so it's just that, yeah, that's like love, or you're giving somebody a gift, you're receiving a gift. It's the, yeah, there's so many different ways you can expand on it. It's like fellowship. It's just sharing time together, that kind of thing. Yeah.
There's so many meanings to that word. And I find that especially people who are multilingual or polyglots, there are definitely words that don't carry the same meaning or don't have a translation in English, because they often embody multiple sets of terminologies, and they embody both spiritual and mental and emotional and physical. And you can use it in different sentences and it will mean different things. I think diversity is our strength, and everybody says that like to be able to bring aspects of Tongan culture to our patients and to be able to bring Tongan culture to our Tongan patients in the same way that I can bring Chinese culture to our Chinese patients is a real strength. That's building rapport with those relationships and trust as well. And you end up better for, like, it's better for everybody in the end, which is a really simplistic and naive way to put it.
But it's just, it's fact, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just, it's something that I worked pretty hard, you know, that to impress on my junior staff in terms of taking time with patients and, yeah, just that forming trust between yourself and them and their family. Yeah, so I really, even when I'm busy and I'm rushing around the ward, I do make an effort to spend time, listen to the patients. If family members are around, I encourage them to ask questions. Basic stuff that we all do all the time. It's something that I think is really important.
Yeah, completely.
I've seen so many examples of terrible bedside manner. And yeah, it's something that I try and model well for junior staff. And I'm definitely not perfect at it, but it's something, you know, that I think we can all, I can definitely improve on, and something I'm continually working on.
Absolutely. And I think some of it is that there is a pressure to assimilate with the current culture and the current model of care. So if swimming against the current all the time, to be able to be like, no, I'm actually not okay with doing a 5-minute ward round, or I'm not okay with giving the discharge summary to somebody else to then pass to the patient because I couldn't be bothered talking to them myself. Like, it's all those little things that it's actually really difficult to keep swimming against that, because that is the expectation. That is the model of care that we have. It's not patient-centered. It's clinician-centered at the moment. And that's so hard to convey, which is a really scathing review of the healthcare system. But yeah.
No, I 100% agree. The whole idea of being patient-centered, in some cases, I'm just astounded. We, for example, in our hospital, our patients, they come for a clinic appointment and you see them in person, and then you might organize an investigation. So then that involves another trip to the hospital for an investigation. And then they often get booked for a follow-up appointment, which is the third trip. And then they get booked for surgery. And so then they have to come and see an anaesthetist, which is what, we're up to trip number 4. And then they come the day before the operation to be consented by the team and meet the anaesthetist who's going to be looking after them on the day. And they go home, and then they come back in again for their surgery. So that's a minimum of 6 hospital appointments. And we wonder sometimes why people don't show up, because it's people literally have to rearrange their lives to make these appointments. I think one silver lining of COVID is that we've changed a lot of our clinic follow-up, for example, is often done by phone, which we have a pretty significant Māori and Pacific Island DNA rate. Sorry, do not attend. It's a terrible term, did not attend term. I think that moving to making even some of the first specialist appointments to phone has definitely reduced that DNA rate, because these patients are often the single breadwinner for the family. They can't afford to take, what did I say, 6 days of work plus time in hospital when they're actually having a procedure plus recovery time. That's huge. And a phone call when they can, in their lunch break, I think has meant that we are moving a bit more towards that patient-centered treatment and plans, because it's 100% needed. And I think they just get lost in the system sometimes, and powers that be don't always, who aren't necessarily on the coal face treating these patients and hearing about this poor patient who has to take a whole day off work. They can't just take an hour off to come in and have the appointment that you've organized for them. Unfortunately they don't have as much of an appreciation for that side of things.
And it's not until you see these patients for yourself that you realize how much of a strain the hospital system is for their life. We are not equipping them in the right way. And so our most at-risk and most vulnerable populations are the ones that constantly get labeled with DNAs. And these labels are inherently violent and they're racist, because it's always those specific populations, isn't it? And there's always like an angry DNA letter, like, how dare you stand us up? And it's, but the patients have their own lives, and we demanded that they showed up at this appointment. Like, they didn't even get a say in what time or date or like nothing.
Yeah. Exactly. We just don't know what's going on in the inpatient's life. If you're the single breadwinner and you've got to
No sick leave, no transport.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're caring for a relative who's unwell. On top of all of that,
you know, live miles away because all the central suburbs are gentrified.
Exactly. Yeah. All of those things just make it so challenging for lots of different groups of patients. But yeah, unfortunately, the same group of patients just are marginalized and, as you say, get labeled with these really violent, terrible terms.
I always wonder, Rochelle put out a really good talk where she talks about why can't we make clinics like hairdresser appointments where patients can book in to see us, because we're doing the clinic in that time slot anyway. So it's not like they're inconveniencing us. At least then they can dictate their own schedules and come at a time. And that serves both of us. It serves you because then you're not sitting around waiting for a patient who is never going to show up because they couldn't make it anyway. And it serves them because they get to see you. And so these things sound so simple, like it's so hard to implement for whatever reason.
Absolutely. Yeah. I tried to kickstart an initiative in our hospital where for the Māori and Pacific Island patients, right, we would have somebody from the whānau care team and the Pacific Island health team within the hospital make contact with them before their appointment at some point and just prep them and help troubleshoot any questions, offer to attend the appointment with them and if it was going to be in person and as a support person. And it sort of got off the ground, but then although there was a lot of enthusiasm for it and everybody could see that this was likely to have a positive impact on patient. And for the short period of time that we had it running, the feedback from the patients was amazing. But those services were so stretched that they just had to pull out of this, you know, this intervention, and they've had to, of course, focus their attention and energy to other areas. And it's just, man, this feels like this massive missed opportunity where we could have made a real difference for these patients who are, you know, most at risk. And yeah, anyway, I'm not giving up. Going to happen.
It's a work in progress, and it sounds like a great initiative and one that would obviously have positive outcomes. It's just a matter of being able to implement it in a sustainable way. And it's always tough because the departments that are like Māori health liaison and Pacific health liaisons often really short staffed and chronically underfunded.
Yes.
So it's almost like they're set up to fail because suddenly they can't deliver on the things that they promise. And it's because they were never set up to deliver the things that they promised.
Yeah.
And then people are like, oh, look, like their service never works.
incredibly frustrating.
Frustrating. Lupe, I want to take this opportunity to say thank you. Thank you so much for sharing your journey all the way from Tonga and your grandfather and your legacy in medicine and what you've carried with you. Thank you for sharing your journey in vascular and your love for transplant surgery and, of course, your love for manky feet. We must carry that on. We must spread the word.
Actually, yeah, go ahead, spread the word. I tell everyone I love manky feet. So it's all good. I'm comfortable with that label.
You've owned it. Yeah, you've owned it.
Yep, yeah. It.
Thank you so much. I'm really grateful for your time.
Thank you, Mabel. It's been such an honour to be, to be part of your podcast, and I've really enjoyed it.
This podcast was made possible by the New Zealand Doctors Residents Association Education Trust. Thank you for listening. Mā te wā.